So we're a week away from a live Christmas Eve show here on Coast to Coast. I hope you join us. It will be very good. We'll be talking a little bit about hypnotism, and we'll be looking ahead to 2012 about what your dreams are telling you about you with our friend Dr. Judith Orloff and others. Tonight, we're going to have another hour here with David Elkington. We're talking about the Jordan Codices. We'll get to some open lines coming up in our final hour, and also an update from Captain Kelly Sweeney about a couple of very interesting stories in the news this week. We will give you a chance to jump in on the phones coming up later on this hour, however, to talk about these metal books, these codices, a codex in plural form, codices. And these metal books are a threat to some. Some people might feel very threatened. Other people are claiming that they're just simply, there can't be any truth to them, so there's no threat at all. And the rest of us are just kind of waiting to see when the Jordanian government is going to say that they are authentic, and when more and more scholars are going to come out and explore the possibility that they are real publicly. And we'll get back to that coming up with David Elkington next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. If you want more background on the Jordan Codices, you can do that by going to coasttocoastam.com. And you can link onto the story there that explains everything so well. But let's just sum it up by saying David Elkington himself didn't find these metal books, but rather was brought into the project to help understand what's in them and to spearhead the effort to authenticate them, which is coming along, although there's a lot of different books. And so even if some of them end up being found to be fakes, it doesn't mean that they all are. And that's part of what we're sorting out here on Coast to Coast. What's in these books, these what might be sort of proto books of the Bible, and or at least maybe even an alternative version of some of the texts that we know that exist in the Bible, in the Christian Bible, especially as we know it today. And so, David Elkington, we've been talking about, you know, the exploration into the physical aspects of the Bible, and we talked about the of these codices, and then we talked about some of the content, and you read us a line from that. Tell me what the reaction has been to you personally for having done this. I mean, how are you being received as the head of the team, as it were, to authenticate the Jordan Codices?
Well, you know, it's been a huge privilege to be part of the team, let alone to sort of be, I guess, leading it in some way, shape, or form. Although I hope that very soon we'll hand over to our friends at the Department of Antiquities in Jordan, who have done a fantastic job so far and have been incredibly supportive. But, you know, to be working with some of the most extraordinary names in the business, whose work is simply staggering, to put it mildly, it has been just quite extraordinary. And the response to me personally, though, has been quite interesting. We've had an immense amount of support from the scholarly world just for pursuing this in an open-minded way and trying our best to be responsible in terms of making sure that these things, you know, are tested and tested thoroughly, and for having produced, you know, results in a fit and proper fashion. But there have been those who have been detracting from this, saying that they're fakes and they're inauthentic. There's even been a group of people that, undergraduates, believe it or not, who've actually called personally one or two of the scholars on the team, professors in their own right, to tell them that they are wrong, which has been quite interesting, I have to say. But, you know, until we can release more information and until we can release the results of the analysis, which is not for us to do, that is for the Jordanian government to do, then unfortunately, you know, we can't really sort of say too much else about it, because once people see quite what we've done, quite how they've been tested, and where, of course there will be questions about what these things represent. Are they real? Are they inauthentic? And of course, you know, it's understandable people would want to ask those questions. But until this information has been released, no doubt this will continue. And as I say, you know, we welcome open debate, but let's make sure that it's academic and responsible and not personal, because sometimes it does get a bit personal, because, of course, you know, a discovery like this can inflame the passions.
How would these attacks turn personal against you?
There's been all sorts of stuff, you know, talking about, you know, aspects of my private life and all of that. But, you know, I don't want to discuss my private life. It has nothing to do with the project. It certainly has nothing to do with the discovery and its authentication. We want to keep this on a firm academic footing. It's responsible, and it's the way in which we can really bring people into the discussion of the discovery, etc.
Well,
we want
that,
people
but...
to sort of enjoy this, you know, and we want them to take part in it. And you know, we know these things are authentic, as I say. It's time now to kind of disseminate the information in a responsible and reasonable manner.
But these personal attacks, these ad hominem attacks about you as opposed to the text, I mean, are they saying, you know, things, mild things like, you know, David Elkington's mother dresses him funny? Or, I mean, are they getting deeply personal?
Some of them have accused me of actually rewriting the metal reports. We've posted a couple of the metal reports on the Facebook page. And it's very flattering that they think that I've got the qualifications to do such a thing, but I'm afraid to say that I'm not a metallurgist, and I wouldn't have the expertise to be able to edit, let alone to rewrite these things. And also, we posted on the Facebook page a series of photomicrographs of the surface of the lead, which shows in detail the necessary impurities and their distribution inside the metal. And, of course, there's no way that I could possibly have those things faked or forged. So the argument's kind of gone from whether the Jordan codices are authentic to whether I personally am authentic. I think I might have myself tested quite soon, and I'll let you know what the results are.
Perhaps you don't exist. Perhaps you were...
You know, that's a very good metaphysical question. Do any of this exist? Is it all an illusion?
And if we were found by Bedouins, does that mean we don't exist? You know, so yeah. So very interesting, and thank you, David, for answering that question. Because I hate to think that. I mean, again, we're all waiting for that kind of authentication that would settle this question one way or another. But I track with your sincerity on this, and I'm giving, you know, I don't. It's not a stretch for me to go. And give you the benefit of the doubt. I think, like you, we're all looking for that time when you've got what we would call that slam dunk that just says, this is it. This settles it once and for all. Let me go back to something you had brought up before about these about the content in the codices being temple-based. And you were talking about the relationship to the periods of the temple, the central, the heart of Judaism being located in the temple. What do we learn differently about the temple of ancient times from these codices that you think is informative today?
Well, you know, it's essential to get a grip on the whole idea of the centrality of the temple in order to understand the codices and the way they're going to change our perceptions about the origins of Christianity and its rise. Because, you know, we have an episode in the Gospels where Jesus goes into the temple, having been acknowledged as king, you know, as the son of David by the crowds on his entry into Jerusalem. He then goes into the temple and he casts out the money changers. And it's always struck me as being very strange that the episode seems to end there. And then, of course, we go on then to the crucifixion narrative. It seemed to me very strange. I mean, you know, casting out the money changers. I mean, look at today's problems we have with bankers and, you know, too few people making too much money. We'd all sympathize with that. But then, you know, you've got the hero. He comes in. He does what we would all like to do today. He sweeps away these horrible people who are making money out of others who can't afford it. And then for that, he's crucified. It seems very, very strange to me that they should end it there. And it seems to me that from what the codices are saying, that when Jesus actually went to the temple, he didn't just go and clear out the money changers. He went much further, that he actually went deep into the interior of the temple. And to get a sense of how important the temple was, it's essential to see that, you know, at the very heart, at the very beating heart of the temple, there was a small square box called the Holy of Holies. And in there, it was believed that God actually lived, actually resided. Now, that seems absurd. But take yourself to that wonderful scene in that extraordinary film, Raiders of the Lost Ark, where eventually Indiana Jones and his Arab helper, they actually find the Ark, and they bring it out of the box. And you can remember that feeling of awe that we all had when sitting in the cinema, as you see this gleaming gold box that came out of this wooden crate, and suddenly there it is, the Ark of the Covenant. Well, the Ark itself was a tabernacle in the desert for the exiles, the children of Israel under Moses. And in that sense, what you've got with the temple is you've got a much bigger tabernacle. You know, the Ark itself was a portable meeting place for God and his children. What you have with the temple and its building under Solomon is a much grander place. So, of course, in the days of Solomon, the Ark itself was placed deep inside the Holy of Holies, and there God would sit in glory. Now, Jesus is called the Son of God Most High, and there are references in the Gospels to his glory. They're talking here about, you know, something that may well have happened, which isn't described in the Gospels. And from what I can make out so far, in terms of the imagery and the translations that we've got so far from the codices, it seems to me that there are references to Jesus going far deeper into the temple and actually meeting with God. And that is fascinating.
And that there might be some reflection of that in the Jordan codices.
Indeed, there might well be. In fact, I've discovered one or two aspects to them that seem to confirm that. And in fact, I've just compiled a book with my wife Jennifer, and it will all of our findings will be coming out in that book, hopefully in the early part of next year. So I'll, as soon as we have a publication date and more details, I'll happily tell your listeners exactly where they can get hold of it and give them more details.
Good. I look forward to that. And more photographs, too, because those are very interesting. We are talking about the Jordan codices, and again, you can see photographs of what we're talking about by linking up to an article in an online article from earlier this year at coasttocoastam.com. I know we're going to get to some calls here coming up for you at the bottom of the hour, but let me ask you, David, about the other aspects of the investigation, for example, into an update perhaps on the person that found the codices and the person that bought the codices. Any other word? I mean, at some point it seemed like there were some kind of shady characters involved. Have they been either further implicated or further exonerated for any of these other fraudulent creations that they've been linked to in the past?
Investigations are ongoing at the moment, and obviously, you know, we're helping as much as we can. But one thing I would like to say to your listeners is that the Bedouin who came to us, Hassan, with these original books and images, you know, he's a typical Bedouin in that sense. He's a poor man. He's not educated. He came to us because he wanted to find out what these things were, and we were able to tell him. And I have to say that although he smuggled them across the border from Israel to from Jordan to Israel, he has actually been an extraordinarily good guardian of these wonderful things. He's looked after them. He's taken extreme care with them. And we have been trying over the past 3 or 4 years to get him to see the point of actually repatriating these things back to Jordan. And Jennifer and I wish him well. We really hope that There's a good resolution to this. Unfortunately, there have been some rather shady and shadowy characters behind Hassan, one or two of whom I'm afraid to say I brought onto the team initially, who could only see the money side of it and have therefore tried to turn him against the idea of allowing public access to these things because they'd like to see them sold on the black market for huge amounts of money. And it's very tragic that when you find something like this, that instead of actually thinking for the wider world and contributing something which may have been, maybe of huge international importance and give us a new understanding of Christian origins and a greater understanding of the links between Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, instead of any of that, that these people would just want to sell them and just get rid of them for profit. That's pretty sad, I have to say. But we're working with the authorities to try and bring about a peaceable resolution to this. And I'm hoping we'll have news again on that in the next few months or so.
Well, thank you for taking that question, because I know that's an aspect of this that you can't control. But it does shed light, at least in some respects, on the credibility of the handover and the origin, perhaps. So thank you for that perspective, that update, because I believe that, even as we know in the case of the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have a very innocent version of the story that's told of this shepherd boy throwing rocks into a cave trying to find a lost goat. But other people have always questioned that and said, no, he was trying to find antiquities like everybody else was. He wasn't looking for a goat. So the innocent version makes it sound, adds to the credibility of the discovery. Whereas if he were really just trying to find something, people would say people who are trying to find something will be inclined to fake it so that they would, maximize their odds of finding something.
That's a really good point because, we've chronicled the entire story along with the history in our book, Divine Revelation is what we're going to call it. But what's curious about the discovery, people say, oh, they're cooked up Bedouin fakes. Well, this is really interesting because, as I said, there's only a handful of scholars in the world who can understand and read Hasmonean Paleo-Hebrew. If we therefore consider these things to be not authentic, then you're looking here at an incredible group of geniuses on a scale with Einstein, I'd say, because not only can they actually falsely corrode lead to the extent where you've got very, very rare crystalline deposits on the surface that are so light sensitive that after 2,000 years, they actually fade away within minutes. Not only can they concoct that, but they can also speak fluent Paleo-Hebrew of the Hasmonean variety. And on top of that, they know their biblical history so well that they can actually cook up the symbols and place them in such a way that actually they tell us a story which we can confirm is in the Gospels. Now, if it should turn out to be the case, then all I can say is, let's get these guys together, let's find out who they are, and let's give them professorships at top American universities, right, because they are very, very good at what they do.
Give me 30 seconds on, before we get to the calls coming up, on if any aspect of these books change the resurrection story. We touched on it earlier, but I can't remember what the headline would be on that. Confirms exactly as it's told or challenges aspects of it?
I can confirm that a resurrection did take place. It was a physical resurrection, of course. And I can confirm that the codices do talk about this. We're looking into it further now. But if anybody wants to actually look at this further, they want to investigate it for themselves, I'll give them a really good clue. If they go to the Gospel of Philip, one of the supposed Gnostic Gospels,
right,
it might well turn out that Philip is not a Gnostic gospel, but in fact it's an ordinary gospel, but one that's been sidelined because it doesn't adhere to the orthodoxy presented in the four main gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So if you go to the Gospel of Philip, you'll see a text there about resurrection, and I have to say it's profoundly beautiful.
Okay, interesting clue. Thank you. I appreciate that. I've got Philip on my bookshelf. I'm going to go grab it right now. And then we'll give you the numbers. We'll roll them right at you if you want to join in the conversation with David Elkington. Before we get to open lines in our last hour on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So, Alive Christmas Eve slash Christmas morning show a week from tonight on Coast to Coast. Hope you join us if you're up and about. Should be a fun one. We should look forward to 2012. We also did a little of that in our first hour, talking about the secret peace. Are things so much better than anybody really knows? And are you willing to accept the fact that things are better, despite tragedies in the world, that things could be so much worse? If you missed it, go back and listen to it if you've got Coast Insider. And you can find out more by going to coasttocoastam.com. Look forward to talking to you during the week at my Twitter account, Deacon Punnett. I do so much better there than I do with Facebook. I guess I've got sort of increasing privacy concerns with Facebook anyway, so I'm reluctant to get into a deep Facebook life, but I like Twitter, so I've been having fun with that, and I hope you join me, and I try to write back to everybody. I'm a little behind right now, but I'll get caught up later on. By the way, saw the new Mission Impossible movie today, Ghost Protocol. Saw it in IMAX. Highly recommend seeing it in IMAX, especially for that great tower sequence. It really is. It's breathtaking, and it's amazing to think, as much as, you know, Tom Cruise is surrounded by weirdness, that you got to give him his props for those stunts, because he did them, not every actor could do it. A lot of actors have terrible acrophobia. I think Sylvester Stallone, John Travolta, somebody once said, but I don't know, but Sylvester Stallone for sure. Could never have done what Tom Cruise did. And if you'll get a chance to see it coming up as it gets into wider distribution. Worth it. It's fun. And let's get to your calls coming up next for David Elkington. I think there's one wild card line, and we'll get to everybody else coming up next. And then we'll go to open lines coming up in our last hour on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Interesting. Looking at a review of the Gospel of Philip by Bart Ehrman, who we have on the show from time to time, and he's harsh in his criticism of the Gospel of Philip you were just talking about, but he did make the point that I think you were making when he talks about Philip's version of the resurrection story, that he has Philip describing Jesus as saying, it was on the cross that he said these words, my God, why have you forsaken me? Or rather interpreted, my God, why have you mocked me in the Gospel of Philip? And it says, for there on the cross, he was divided. And the division, I believe, is referring to sort of that Gnostic understanding of the body and soul. But I could be wrong on that. I have to spend more time with that when I'm also not trying to do a radio show at the same time. And other people have their questions for David Elkington, the Jordan Codices. Let's get to Jeff in Culver City, California, on Coast to Coast for David Elkington. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing, Ian and Mr. Elkington? Yes, it's interesting that you are talking about the missing books found in Jordan, but what I've been wondering about is the three books of the Bible that are missing, and it is the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Thomas, and the Gospel of Judas. These are three principal characters in Jesus' life, yet these books were omitted from the Bible and held somewhere in the Vatican. Why was this done, Mr. Elkington, and why was the Bible tampered with in the first place? And I'll take your answer off the air.
Well, I don't know that David wants to answer all of that, but I have an opinion on that. Go ahead, David.
Merry Christmas, my friend. I just wanted to say that those are very, very intriguing Gospels that you mentioned, but of course, when we look at the making of the New Testament, you've got to think here less of religion and more of politics. It was, founded and formed in large part under the influence of the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD under the Emperor Constantine, who was the emperor of the Roman Empire. And as you can imagine, therefore, they needed to have an official slant on their new religion, this new Christianity. And that's the reason why you'll find that certain of the Gnostic Gospels have now become lost books of the Bible, even though some of them only really verge on Gnosticism and seem more orthodox than not.
Well, I'm just going to say that when he said they're being held by the Vatican, that's not true. You can get copies of these. You can read these. And
yes,
so...
Yeah.
I mean, so
yeah, they're freely available, actually.
They're freely available. They're available online. They're everywhere. So, I mean, it's just a false claim to say that the Vatican holds them and we can't know what's in them. And as far as, you know, the Gospel of Judas, let's put aside the other two mentioned, because Gospel of Thomas, I believe, was probably written before the four Gospels that we know. But the Gospel of Mary or the Gospel of Judas, highly questionable, particularly because if we accept the fact that Judas kills himself, when did he have time to sit down and write the gospel? So, I mean, I know that there are...
Well, that would be a fantastic conversation to have. It's interesting, you know, a good point about the Gospel of Thomas is that Thomas is all about the sayings of Jesus. He doesn't actually give us a story.
No.
And that's interesting. If it's the earliest of the Gospels, then you've got to ask yourself, well, where did the story come from? That's a very good question.
Yeah. Let's go to Will in Madison on a wild card line on Coast to Coast. Will, you're just going to have to keep this short here. I know you probably have a lot to say about it, but you have a question?
My call. I wish to mention the likely base, root, origin of the tribal words, names of Nazarenes and Essenes. But I need to give you just a little bit of background why I present this idea of the root base of Nazarenes, and that is that in a map, is a book, The Life of Charlemagne by Einhard, published Ann Arbor paperbacks, 1960, on page 21, there's a map that shows that the Estonians, yes, were in Denmark and in England before 800 A.D., and Einhard was a Latin scholar. He was a secretary to the son of Charlemagne. And they just mentioned, you'll look on page 37, they mentioned the AST, the Estonians. And so therefore, the root, the base of Nesarnayat, Nazarenes, Nesarnayat, that is Finno-Ugric. These were the people who lived in Northern Europe long ago, the Aboriginal people, means sermon, and Essenes, Esitayat, the presenters. And I just want you to kindly to think about the possibility that Jesus may have spoken a native tongue, Finno-Ugric.
Okay. I will. I promise you, I'll make a note that I will consider Jesus was Finnish. In the meantime, let me grab first-time caller line, Chris. Is hanging on for David Elkington on Coast to Coast. Chris?
How you doing tonight? Merry Christmas.
Thank you, too.
I just had a question about Jesus and his death. He was able to heal people, and they put him in the tomb, and it took several guys to push the door closed for the tomb, but they found the tomb was open and Jesus was gone, or supposedly resurrected to heaven. How come Jesus wasn't able to heal himself? Or why shouldn't we think that Jesus couldn't have healed himself and his friends or compadres or whatever came and got him out of that tomb? Because after that, the Knights Templars went and dug up all of his artifacts, and then they fought to the death for something. They went up into the Swiss mountains, and the only person that could protect you, because the English didn't want to go up into the Swiss mountain because they would die from cold, and the only person that could protect you that well is Jesus.
All right, so, you got a lot going on in there to kind of unpack a little bit. I don't know whether David can relate to any of that. Go ahead, David.
Well, I think it's a good question. The thing is that there's two points to be made here. Jesus was sharing his spirit, the spirit of God, with the rest of humanity. And therefore, he himself would have been a bit of an opt-out on that clause, because it would have made him more a superhuman, more a god than a human. And the incarnation was about God becoming human, and therefore sharing the experience of being divine with us, and making us more self-aware and more self-conscious. And second to that, when we speak about angels, you know, the Hebrews saw angels as kind of being priests in a heightened state. The angel in a lot of Middle Eastern ancient languages actually means messenger, and those messengers invariably came in human form. Now, although they believed in the spirits of angels, for sure, for those angels to actually take on human form means that their spirits had to enter human beings in order to actually come down here to Earth. So when we say that angels actually moved the stone of the tomb, you could be saying here, actually, it was human beings who used the stone, but they were representing the words of Jesus in terms of how they wrote about him and spoke about him in the moments after the resurrection. So there's a lot to think about on that point.
I just happen to be preaching on that tomorrow morning. Well, and check that, 6 hours. And so I've been doing a lot of work on that. And to me, the interesting part is that there's one interpretation of angel fairly consistently that just means news bearer. And it doesn't by definition mean divine. And that if somebody is a messenger of God or a news bearer, they can be imbued with the Holy Spirit without being divine. And that word angel or messenger often gets used to, for example, to talk about the prophets, and which we know to be human. So I think there are other ways of looking at that word that also might shed some light.
The word gospel means good news, which is you know, again, proves your point in that sense too. So in that way, what we have is the divine working through humans in order to actually give us a greater sense of things beyond the experience of this earth. And we mustn't forget either that of course, in the first century, life was a lot tougher than it is today. And people wanted to have that connection simply to be able to think, well, is it really worth living? Is it really worth existing? And when life gets tough, I must admit, you have a tendency to pray a lot more.
Right. And not to mention, you just want to pray just so you might be able to live to the ripe old age of 35 in ancient times. Michael is in Tidewater, east of the Rockies on Coast to Coast. Michael?
Yes, thank you. David Elkington, you quoted from the book of Daniel earlier. I'm going to challenge you a little bit. And then after you give your answer, I'm going to respond to you in less than 15 seconds. As my comeback. But
okay.
Here's the
Gotta
thing.
Be quick here. Go ahead.
Here's the thing. you used the term Antichrist, and in doing that, you did it the way most preachers and prophecy buffs use that term. You did it without defining it. You did it without showing that it's very different in its original meaning and in its Christian, first century Christian meaning than it is today. Now, when the Roman Catholics talk about the anti-popes in history, they generally talk about men who were contenders for the throne of the papacy. In other words, they were imposters. And that is exactly the original way that term is used in the New Testament when referring to the Antichrist. Now, the only way there could have been an Antichrist is for someone to have proclaimed himself, not just himself Christ, but for him to have been recognized by authorities in Israel as an alternate king.
Okay, I'm not sure of that, Michael, but we need this to be a dialogue a little bit, and I don't know how long this is going to last. Can we get to a question?
Yeah. Here's the question.
Okay.
When the Sanhedrin, those 70 sons that you referred to earlier, said, "We have no other king but Caesar," they at that point inaugurated the Antichrist. And that throne continues to exist today as the Pontiff of Rome.
Well, I would totally disagree with that based on the New Testament. I don't know whether you know how often Antichrist is used as plural. And it was Antichrist not with a capital A, but with a lowercase a, meaning anybody that was against Christ was being called out as Antichrist.
So, I know all of that, but I...
Well, just so you know, so when it sounds like you're anti-the Pope or anti-Catholic Church, and you're trying to use that to make a point, so I would just pull back the lens a little bit to say not quite as clear as you would claim. But David, you want to throw yourself in there?
Yeah, I just like to say that, you know, it might well be that the Jordan Codices represent a challenge for Christianity, but I suspect that at the end of the day, all it's going to do is actually it's going to confirm an awful lot of what the Gospels say, except with various subtle differences. And the key point here is that a lot of the churches were founded on the basis of the Gospels. We've got something here which dates from before the Gospels. So obviously, you know, you've got historical documents that might well go back to the very days of Jesus himself. And that's going to take a lot of rethinking for a lot of these organizations who have based dogma and doctrine upon them. Now, whether that's good or bad, it's not for me to say. But I want to promote open and welcome debate between all denominations and all religions in order that we can understand these things more clearly and ultimately understand ourselves more clearly. I don't make any exceptions there. I think anybody who believes in the idea of God is very, very welcome on this debate. And that's to be promoted because it creates wisdom and understanding between human beings. And next week we celebrate the birthday of Christ. It's goodwill to all men. And I just wish to extend my good wishes and Merry Christmas to your listener.
Dan is in Washington on Coast to Coast for David Elkington in the time we have left. Dan?
Just taking my call. I'm one of the skeptics.
You're breaking up, Dan.
Okay, let me see.
That's better. That's better. Don't move. Stay right there. Okay, go ahead. Okay. You got a question?
I'm one of the skeptics when it comes to the codices, and I wanted to ask a question. I have a concern with interview that you and Mr. Elkington did, where he talks about the script, saying it isn't Aramaic, it's a square script, which is Hebrew, and it's Paleo-Hebrew, and it's very ancient. And my specialization is Hebrew, and I completely disagree with pretty much every statement that he makes about the script in that interview, and particularly the notion.
Well, let's give him a chance to respond. We don't have a ton of time here, Dan, so you made your point. Okay, so about, let's leave you up with David. Go ahead, David.
Well, I'm afraid to say if you disagree, then that's absolutely fine. But the problem is you're going to be disagreeing with the world's greatest experts on this. And beyond a doubt, it is square script, Hasmonean, Paleo-Hebrew. And what I'll do is I'll post on Facebook page quite soon the confirmation of that, because there's no doubt about it. It is what it is. And if you're an expert in Hebrew, then I recommend you go back to the textbooks and carry on looking. And I wish you the best wishes with that as well, because Hebrew is a difficult language at the best of times, and the Paleo version is even more difficult. So best of luck with that, and thanks very much for your healthy skepticism.
Dan, you got about 20 seconds.
Okay. Well, to start off, Paleo-Hebrew is not the square script. Paleo-Hebrew is before the square script. The square script is the more modern Hebrew that's a derivative of the Aramaic.
Okay, that's about the time we have, but appreciate that. And we'll just leave that there for now and let you all settle that when you get online and take a look at what David's going to post. Thank you so much for your time, David, and for giving us a few more glimpses at this. Find out more by going to coasttocoastam.com, and we look forward for an update from the Jordanian government in 2012. Open lines next.